Greetings to the brightest audience in the nation. I am not Bob Enyart. He's the pastor of Denver Bible Church, and I am aspiring to become the nation's most popular, self-proclaimed, anti-choice, homophobic. I lost my train of thought, man. I couldn't pull it off. Anyway, I had all these stories that I wanted to do yesterday, and I just want to let you know that Bob is doing well. He's doing much better. But he's working on a big project to deal with objections to Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. And so that project is so big and so enormous, it's like looming over Bob. And so we've decided to come into the studio and relieve him of his duties today so that he can work on... Well, there's a lot of math involved and research, and it's difficult. It's not like just sitting down here in front of a microphone and just spouting off, which is what I'm going to do. I know some talk show hosts say that this is very hard to do. If you only knew how hard it is, you know, and like, you know, Rush Limbaugh, he needs talent on loan from God to sit in front of a microphone and talk about the news. It's really not that hard. And so I'll try to prove that today by doing a good show now that I've put myself on the spot. But Bob will be back, possibly tomorrow. If not, then I'll come back, but he'll probably be back tomorrow. And I'm breathlessly anticipating this series of shows that Bob is putting together, dealing with what he calls the alleged heat problem with the hydroplate theory. And the interesting thing about talking with Bob is that he quite often talks on a level that's so far above your head that you feel like, you feel kind of dumb. This morning, I talked to Bob this morning on the phone about the heat problem, and he started talking about the strong force and the weak force and quarks and neutrons and protons, and he said something like, I probably get this wrong, but he said, well, you know how a proton is 300 times the size of a neutron? And I was like, no, I didn't know that at all. And I probably got it backwards right there when I just said it because I had no clue. But he knew that. And anyway, so Bob is postulating questions that even make physicists scratch their heads. And so we've got him off doing that important research. And as I sit down in the studio today, sitting on the desk here at Bob's right, where he puts all of his important documents, there's a book entitled The Meaning of Human Existence. Has Bob talked about this on the air? This book? He has talked a little bit about it? I just thought the title was compelling. It seems like an awful lot of pages. I think I could get to the meaning of human existence in one paragraph. But is Bob positive about this book, or do you have any idea? I'm asking the board op. He's not sure about Bob's take, and I'm not familiar with the author, so I don't want to get into it here. It appears to be written by a British fella, which explains why there's so many pages. They're really smart. You know, they write everything with a British accent. That's why Americans love British publications so much. Anyway, I may take a look at this book after I get off the air, just to find out what's going on. Find out if maybe I missed something, and you actually need, 140 pages to, is that what we got here? About 130 pages. So I thought I could explain it in a paragraph. Should I just do it? The meaning of human existence is to love God and love one another. That's the meaning of human existence. There. I just saved you 127 pages. All right, but let's get to, do we want to talk about the news of the day? So I just got a notification from my computer. Have you noticed this lately, that now every website wants to tell you that they're going to put cookies in your computer? Like, we didn't know that already, but now you have to agree to it. So what's the deal with that? Now I have to take an extra 3 seconds. I open 50 websites a day. I have to take 3 seconds every time to say, I'm okay to put the cookies on, don't put the cookies on. Now I have to make a choice. Before, you just put the cookies on. I never cared, nor did I even know. Now every website tells me that they're about to put cookies on my website. There. So I just said, no, thank you. And I had to click two screens. All right. And that's just so I can look at the news of the day so that I have something to talk about here on this extremely with this extremely difficult task of getting on the air and trying to to try to be entertaining, but from a biblical worldview. And that's harder than what most people do, because other people, they can tell dirty jokes and they can do things that are just outside of the bounds of just civil behavior. And we don't do that here. We don't work blue here at Bob and Yart Live. In fact, I have a Facebook friend. He's not really my friend. I don't even like the guy, but somehow he's my Facebook friend, and he'll post some very interesting defenses of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and then he'll post other very reasonable political positions, and then he'll post a dirty joke. And so I wrote to him, and I was like, you know what? His last joke was about, you know what I hate, and then something about liberals, and then a dirty joke. And I said, you know what I hate? I hate it when I'm going to Facebook and I see your dirty jokes. I hate that. I don't like it. I've almost unfriended him a couple of times over the whole dirty jokes. And I don't know if he listens to this show, but if you're listening, you know who you are, Randy. Cut it out with the dirty jokes. You can't be preaching the gospel and claiming to be a disciple of Jesus Christ and then telling dirty jokes, okay? It's just unbecoming, all right? And none of us want to see it. We're not even in seventh grade anymore, Randy, for crying out loud. Get out of here with that. I mean, a youthful indiscretion with a dirty joke, I could forgive that when you were like 11. But now, come on. All right. Let's go instead. Let's talk about space aliens. All right, everybody's obsessed with space aliens. I shouldn't say everybody. When I say everybody, I don't actually mean everybody, because I'm not. And my board op, Dom, he's not. He said, Bob's not obsessed with space aliens. But people who don't believe in God are becoming more and more interested in aliens. And if you've listened to the show for any period of time, you know why this is. It's because the Darwinian theory of evolution is on the verge of collapsing under the weight of observed facts and data. It's just not going to stand. In fact, the more we learn about DNA, the more ludicrous Darwinian evolution appears to be. To even atheists are having a hard time choking down this idea about random mutations and undirected natural selection. It's just not going to work out. The math is not on your side. The science is not on their side. And so they're going to reach to the stars. they're going to be reaching for aliens. And according to this article that I downloaded from Technology Review that was sent to me by Joshua, one of our truck driving producers, Joshua works double duty. He drives a truck while producing segments of Bob and Yart Live. Now imagine that. Now that's actually hard to do. And I don't recommend you do that unless you've had the proper training. But Joshua turned me on to this article about, it turns out, have you heard of the habitable zone? Have you heard that that concept? The habitable zone is what scientists call a zone around any given star where it could theoretically be possible for life to exist. They call it the habitable zone, okay? And that zone will support liquid water. That's one of the keys to having a habitable zone. Now, there's other keys that are too complicated for a layman like me, and I can't get into them. They have to do with hydrogen and carbon dioxide and other things. I don't understand all that. But there's a number of characteristics scientists have assigned to the concept of a habitable zone. Because they're looking for aliens. Well, they say they're looking for life, but they're really not looking for life. If you talk to them long enough, you realize they're looking for intelligent life. They're looking for alien beings that will relieve them of the responsibility they have to their creator. That's what they're actually looking for, if you want to get right down to brass tacks. And in order to have that, you have to have a habitable zone for there to be a planet where we can go find the aliens who will reassure the atheists that God does not exist. Okay? And they're out there looking for it. And now it turns out, so they had defined a number of habitable zones around a number of stars out there. But researchers have had to go back to the drawing board, and they have had to revise the definition of a habitable zone. Yes, they now say the habitable zone is significantly smaller than they had thought. It turns out that life is more difficult to maintain than they had thought in the past. And scientists say, now they also say that the habitable zone is tricky to calculate. It's tricky, you see, and that's why they're having to redefine it. Because here's the thing, if you go by the only place in the universe that has proven that it actually is a habitable zone, there's only one so far. And now we've looked at a bunch. I mean, we just looked at Pluto pretty close up, and it was pretty, and it was white, but it did not look habitable. I mean, if you thought it was miserable, out at my house, we got about 10 inches of snow. There was a snowbank in my front driveway at my front gate that I could not drive a Sequoia through. But if you think that's bad, you should go to Pluto. I mean, that looks really cold. Not a habitable zone. So we've looked at all the planets in our solar system. And, oh, by the way, in the previous definition of the habitable zone, if you took the previous definition and applied it to our sun, Mars fell within the habitable zone. Now, I don't think Mars is habitable. That's why I've always questioned the concept of the habitable zone. If Mars is included, walk me through that. How does that work? How could Mars fall into the habitable zone? But anyway, where was I going with that? Oh, we've looked at the nine here in our solar system, and we've looked at many, many hundreds and possibly thousands more, and we haven't seen one bit of evidence of any life except for one. And if you use the Earth, that would be the Earth, by the way, for all of you who matriculated in the government schools, I just want to point out that I was talking about the Earth. That's where we have actually seen habitation. So that's where we inhabit the Earth right now. If you're going to public school, you are inhabiting the Earth. It is a habitable zone. And so if you go by that, well, researchers have done calculations that indicate that if the Earth moved even a tiny little bit one way or the other, or the moon was off by just a little bitty bit, that Earth would suddenly not be a habitable zone. And so I've always been of the impression that the habitable zone was probably as wide as like I-70 around the sun, and that the Earth rides that right in there. That's what I've always thought that the habitable zone would be defined as. And it appears that researchers have taken a step toward actually defining that habitable zone, and it's a lot smaller than we thought. They're saying it's approximately a quarter of the size of what they thought it was, and then in the article they admit that they actually have no idea what it is. So, but it's smaller than we thought. They talk about the inner edge of the habitable zone and the outer edge of the habitable zone. And let me make a bold prediction here on Bob Enyart Live, because Bob Enyart Live and Real Science Radio makes bold predictions all the time. I'm going to make a bold prediction that eventually, once all the data comes in, we're going to find out that the habitable zone is about as wide as I-70. That's going to be my guess. And it's going to be discovered that it's only around one star, and it's only in one galaxy, and that there's actually only one. I think I already made the bold prediction that we will never, ever, ever find any life anywhere out there, ever, never, no matter how long we look and no matter how far we go. All right. That's my bold prediction. Now, that one we probably can't settle up until Judgment Day, right? Probably not. We're not going to be able to settle that until we actually meet the Creator and we can observe the entire universe, which that'll be pretty cool, right? Imagine that. So we spend all of this time and effort down here on Earth, and we have to put up with Richard Branson and who's that other Tesla guy? We have to put up with really annoying billionaires, you know, with Elon Musk. Yeah, all of those. So when we get to heaven, we'll get to hang out with someone who's actually interesting and fun to be around, and he'll take us on space travel. We won't have to put up with billionaire egos and all of that. It'll be very fun. I'm going to look forward to that. So we'll make a note to take. I'll take that question with me into the afterlife. I'll take my bold prediction with me into the afterlife. And then it can be confirmed or it can be refuted, at which time I would be very embarrassed. But it'll be all right. It'll be all right. Okay. Now, do we have any Buddhists in the audience? crickets. I got nothing. No Buddhists. Anyway, my wife is from Japan, and we've been married now. Let's see, we met in the fall of 1988. So we've been together for quite some time. Been together for over 30 years, and I remember when she first became a Christian, we went to a rather interesting Bible study where they were speaking in tongues and flopping around on the floor, and they were laying hands on everything that moved, and she got saved. What can I tell you? That the gospel is powerful. Now, these people, they love the Lord, right? So she gets saved, and we start hunting around for a church, and we had a hard time because, see, I had been raised in a dispensational Christian household, and so I knew just enough of the Bible to be dangerous and to be annoying to pastors. Because I would come to church for 1 week, I would put my money in the plate, and then I would think, okay, by next week that I put the money in the plate, I got the right to ask a question. I was a young Christian, okay, and so I would ask the pastor questions about things like baptism, and boy, that really annoys people when you bring up baptism and tithing. Boy, they didn't want to hear that. And so we had a hard time. We bumped around from church to church. And I asked her at one point, I said, well, like when you're living in Japan and you're like trying to find a Buddhist temple to go and is it problematic with like theology? And she said, you know, I always knew Buddhism was a fake. She said, I never bought into any of that. I said, really? She said, yeah. Yeah, she said, I wasn't really religious. I was pretty sure there was a God and that he was probably upset with me. But I never did buy into the whole Buddhism thing. So she had never shopped around for a Buddhist temple. And from what I can gather, there's not really a whole lot of shopping around. There's not a lot of theological disunity within the whole Buddhist community. And so because of that, because there's very little theological disunity in the Buddhist community, apparently, The Japanese have built an AI Buddhist robot who's going to preach at a Japanese temple. Yes. In fact, this humanoid robot is named after the Buddhist goddess of mercy. The Buddhist goddess of mercy, who I think all Buddhists just agree that, yes, there is a Buddhist goddess of mercy. And there's no arguments within the church about which goddess is the goddess of mercy and I think in Buddhism, you can just make up gods as you go. I think that's acceptable. And so that really helps with keeping everybody up from being disunified when you can just make stuff up. Not to insult any of our Buddhist listeners. I certainly don't want to do that. The guy who used to own my house, he was like an amateur Buddhist dabbler. And he had, when we went to look at the house, he had, I don't know what you call them. He had like bundles of feathers and sticks and leaves, like we woven together and tacked up over the door, and then one over the garage door, and then there was one over the boiler room. And I never did ask him about it because I didn't want to get into a whole thing with him about it. But they were like Buddhist charms that he put up. And I only mention that because just this past weekend, I finally pulled out the screws to all of his charms and I spackled them over is what I did. I spackled over all the Buddhist charm legacy holes that were left in the wall. Hopefully the place doesn't start falling apart now that I've taken away the protection of the, pagan charms that he had. Now, I wanted to get back to this, Kanan Bodhisattva Vara Bodhisattva. Kanan Bodhisattva. That's the Buddhist goddess of mercy, but you already knew that. But this is an AI robot version of Kanan Bodhisattva. And he gave the robot gave its first speech last week and read through the Heart Sutra. Are you familiar with the Heart Sutra? The Heart Sutra is a scripture in Buddhist teaching. Scripture? Are you allowed to use the word scripture with pagan writings? Is that? That just strikes me as not right. Maybe that's just me. I guess if you buy into this, I guess if you're gullible and foolish enough and self-absorbed enough and greedy and lustful enough to buy into the whole Buddhist thing, then I guess you call your book scripture. But strikes me as just not right. Anyway, The Heart Sutra is a teaching that offers a path to overcome all fear, destroy all wrong perceptions, and realize perfect nirvana. Huh. Well, once you get through that, what's left? I mean, what are you going to do for the whole rest of the time you're in the temple once you're there at perfect nirvana? Oh, it's just a path. Well, that gives them a little bit of wiggle room. If it doesn't work, well, you know, son, you are on the path. But the path is long and difficult. And the journey of 1,000 miles to perfect nirvana begins with one step here in the temple. See, anyway, I didn't think that, like, self-absorbed fantasies qualify as scripture. Perfect nirvana. Give me a break. That was one of the things that my wife had difficulty with, the whole concept of nirvana. She said, yeah, that was pretty hard to buy. Yeah, that seemed... It really seemed kind of stupid, is what it was. And so she never bought into that. Anyway, Japanese researchers apparently have been developing a lot of robots. A lot of robots that do a lot of things, and that's because the Japanese people, as a general rule, are no longer marrying or having children. They're just, they've lost interest in perpetuating their civilization. And so they're building robots. They need robots to do things like teach children, comfort the sick and aged. They need robots for that. And disposing of hazardous nuclear waste. That's an interesting combination of teaching children, comforting the sick and aged, and disposing of hazardous nuclear waste. Okay. Well, the last one, I understand that one. In fact, if there's ever a need for a robot, it would be for that. But as far as teaching children... Well, I mean, if you look at the public schools, I mean, we probably could do better with robots. Actually, my oldest daughter, the bird whisperer, she is, for all intents and purposes, she's being educated by a machine. I mean, she watches videos on her computer of a PhD mathematics professor teaching her. What is she learning now? I forget if it's calculus. Or it's trigonometry, or it's one of those other ometries that I never made it past introduction to algebra. That's as far as I went in math. Math was far too precise for me. I preferred English, where you could write a paper. And it was kind of hard if you spelled everything properly and used your punctuation. And as long as you were halfway reasonable, it was pretty hard to fail. But with math, you were either right or wrong. And I was wrong, like, almost half the time. Once I got into algebra, I realized that math was not going to be my strong suit, and I swung over toward the English and the literature end of things because, well, there was just a lot more to work with, I thought, with my creative mind. Can't get real creative with math. Although, my daughter says that's not true. She says you just weren't very good at it, and, you know, so you gave up. But she said it's actually really fun, and you can be creative with it. And that's why she's smarter than I am. All right. So anything more from the Buddhists? that's it. We've got the Kanan Bodhisattva, who hasn't been rolled out in public yet. She's just practicing. I apologize if I've offended the robot by asserting that the goddess of mercy is feminine in any way. All right. Now, I wanted to get yesterday to this story, and I did not have a chance, but one of the authors over at Breitbart, and I didn't write his name down. That always embarrasses me because, you know, if somebody read something I wrote on the air, especially if it was an opinion piece, I would really appreciate if they would mention my name. And so I'm gonna look up this guy here because I don't want to insult him. But he kind of connected the dots on how it could be that Jussie Smollett would do what he did. Because on its face, it seems so ridiculous and absurd what he did that you have a hard time getting your mind around how he ended up in a position to do anything like that, right? I mean, can you imagine? I can't even comprehend in my mind planning or thinking or even having that enter into my mind to do something like that, to pull some kind of hoax on society for whatever reason he did it for. Whether it was just because he's a deranged homosexual, which was my initial That was my initial theory. Or if he was trying to get ratings, or if he was trying to get a bigger salary, or if it was just a cry for help. For whatever reason, I mean, I cannot even imagine that entering my mind to like try to pull a hoax. I just cannot imagine. But Breitbart author Daniel Flynn drew the line through history and really connected some dots for me that I had not seen. I mean, I'd seen them, but I hadn't put them together. He goes back to Harvey Milk. Do you remember Harvey Milk? He was a homo in San Francisco. He was a supervisor there, and he was murdered. And at the time he was murdered, there was a huge outcry that he was murdered because he was a homo. And to this day, if you ask young people, they will say that Harvey Milk was a victim of homophobia and he was killed because he was a homo. But it turns out that's a total lie. The guy who killed him was also a supervisor there in San Francisco. And the man who murdered him, Dan White, shot Harvey Milk to death. He didn't do it because he was a homo. Because how do we know this? Because Dan White had attended gay rights fundraisers, donated to money to defeat anti-gay initiative there in California, voted with Milk on homo rights issues back at the time. It was really just a professional dispute. They hated each other and they were rivals. And as godless heathens in San Francisco often do, one of them chose to murder the other in order to relieve the tension. That's pretty much what but there's a popular myth that has grown up around Harvey Milk that he's some great homo. And his name is on a Navy ship, by the way. Did you know that there's a Navy ship in the United States Navy named for Harvey Milk? That's sickening. He's got his face on a postage stamp. His birthday is a state holiday in California public schools. All because of this myth that he was killed because he's a homo. And then author Daniel Flynn brings up Matthew Shepard. You remember Matthew Shepard? Matthew Shepard was murdered in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998. We covered it here on Bob Enyart Live. We even went to Laramie. Anyway, Matthew Shepard has become a poster child for hate crimes, right? Because while Matthew Shepard was obviously killed by homophobic maniac hicks out there in Wyoming, well, it turns out Matthew Shepard was actually part of an interstate meth trafficking ring. That he was a drug dealer is what he was, and he was a homo. But it turns out the guy who killed him was also a homo. In fact, it's well documented that he was a homo. All the cops knew he was a homo. In fact, they all knew that him and Matthew Shepard were something of an item before one homo decided to kill the other homo. More than likely over drugs that were either stolen or that they wanted to steal. But he wasn't killed because he was a leader in the gay rights movement. And so when he puts all this stuff together, you kind of start to understand how perhaps Jussie Smollett could be so delusional that he could think that victimizing himself could somehow help his career. Now I see it now, and I realize that my initial suspicion was correct. It's because he's a delusional homosexual. That's at the root of it, and the fact that society now practically worships victimhood in every way. Anyway, Bob will be back. And until then, do right and risk the consequences.